Today I'll be reading from Daniel 8. Please follow along on the screen or in your own Bibles. And if you want a physical Bible, please raise your hand and one of the ushers will bring it to you. Daniel 8. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw myself in the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns, standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged towards the west and the north and the south. No animal could stand against it, and none could rescue from its power. It did as it pleased and became great. As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between its eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. It came towards the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at it in great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram and shattering its two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against it. The goat knocked it to the ground and trampled on it, and none could rescue the ram from its power. The goat became very great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came another horn, which started small, but grew in power towards the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry hosts down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away the daily sacrifice from the Lord, and his sanctuary was thrown down. Because of rebellion, the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, "How long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled, the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, the surrender of the sanctuary, and the trampling underfoot of the Lord's people?" He said to me, "It will take 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated." While I, Daniel, was watching the vision and trying to understand it, there before me stood one who looked like a man. And I heard a man's voice from the Ulai calling, "Gabriel, tell this man the meaning of the vision." As he came near the place where I was standing, I was terrified and fell prostrate. "Son of man," he said to me, "understand that the vision concerns the time of the end." While he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Then he touched me and raised me to my feet. He said, "I am going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. The two-horned ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat is the king of Greece, and the large horn between its eyes is the first king. The four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his nation, but will not have the same power. In the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a fierce-looking king, a master of intrigue, will arise. He will become very strong, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy those who are mighty, the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the prince of princes. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. The vision of the evenings and mornings that has been given to you is true, but seal up the vision, for it concerns the distant future. I, Daniel, was worn out. I lay exhausted for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled by the vision. It was beyond the understanding. Here ends the reading.
Okay, am I on? Am I on? Yes, I'm on. Great. Well, we're continuing on our journey through the book of Daniel. And if you're not familiar with Daniel, probably know Daniel from the very familiar children's story, like Daniel in the Lion's Den and the writing on the wall. They all come from the book of Daniel. So we're continuing on our journey. And today we're just going straight into it, looking at Daniel chapter 8. And Daniel chapter 8 is quite a strategic passage section in this book of Daniel. And why is that? Because one thing we often don't realize because we read in English is the book of Daniel was actually written in two different languages. Do you realize that? It was written in Aramaic and it was written in Hebrew. Have a look at how it's broken up, right? You can see that. The Hebrew section of the book of Daniel is actually chapter 1 up to chapter 2, verse 4. It's Hebrew. But when you read Aramaic, when you read chapter 2 to chapter 7, that's in Aramaic. When you come to chapter 8, right through to chapter 12, it goes back to Hebrew. Now, like I said, we don't get to see that because we're all in English. But in actual language, it's actually Aramaic and Hebrew. Now, you've got to ask, why two different languages? Well, here's the thing. Aramaic was the common language of the time. It was comparable to, say, English. You go to many third world countries, or like Southeast Asia, there might be Vietnamese, might be Chinese, but English may be the commercial language of that country. English. Hebrew is the covenant language. It's the language of God's people. So for instance, right, some of us here, we might go one place, we speak the language of the land, might be English. But at home, we will speak Chinese. So just imagine the book of Daniel being English, one section, and Chinese, the other section. This is what's going on here. Now, you've got to ask yourself the question, why is it written in two languages? And that's on purpose. Because Hebrew, the big message of that section that's written in Hebrew is actually to show to you that God, actually, the big message that God cares for his people. It's a message to the people of God. But the middle section, chapters 2 right through to chapter 7, is in Aramaic. And the big message there is that God is in control. Two big ideas. God is in control. That's the message he needs to say to the world. God is in control. And you remember the message that God had to say to Nebuchadnezzar. You're not in control. I'm in control. But the message that God has says to his people, right, is what? That God actually cares for his people. That is the big message. Control and care. When we come to chapter 8 then, which unfortunately, this section, chapters 8 onto 12, is a section which we look at it, it's quite weird when you even read it, when Abby read that so well, rams and goats, and you go and work out what the hell that's got to do. There's sections that we tend to overlook very, very quickly. And that's unfortunate. Because this section, chapter 8 to 12, and the opening chapter, was actually specifically written with you in mind. And the big message that God has to say to you is that God cares for you. Now, that's an important message to be said. Why is that? Because it's a show to people like Daniel at the time and the people in exile that was living in a world of great turmoil and turbulence, messiness, dominated by superpowers all over the place. And people like Daniel think, what's going on with the world? What's going on? Superpowers rising up, coming down, etc., etc. And God has to say to people like Daniel, to us, that in this turbulent, messed up, crazy world dominated by superpowers of light that often are powerful and cruel, God still cares for his people. God still cares for people. And even though the world looks messed up, God is still in control. God is still in control. The world looks like it's in havoc, but God says, no, it is not. Well, let's dip into chapter 8. And let me approach it a couple of ways. Firstly, let me quickly tell you what chapter 8 is about. Get a bit more into details. I won't go into everything because I don't have time. But detail, and then let me draw out three important lessons that chapter 8 brings out for us, okay? Let's have a look at chapter 8, right? Well, first thing we need to understand the context of chapter 8. Notice it's in the third year of King Belshazzar. We first were introduced to Belshazzar back in chapter 5, the writing on the wall. And if you remember that Daniel was to give to Belshazzar that your time is up, the writing's on the wall, God's going to take the kingdom away from you. And that very night, what happened? The Medes and the Babylonians basically destroyed the kingdom of, or the empire of Babylon. That's when we first met Belshazzar. Now, this is the third year of Belshazzar. In other words, what we see in chapter 8 is actually 10 years prior to the fall of chapter 5. So chapter 5 was 10 years after this particular event. So we're now going back in time. And as you can see from the vision in the passage read out, it has a vision of a powerful ram. You saw that. That's covered for us in chapter 3 to 5. In chapter 3, all right? In my vision, I saw in the citadel, in the province of Elam, in the vision I saw beside the Ulai covenant. What? And what I see? Okay, let's know what that's there for. I think I missed that verse there, right? It's a vision of a ram, and a powerful ram. And as you can remember, it was, in that vision was followed by a powerful goat that had one large horn that was later broken and broken into four smaller horns in verses 5 to 8. And then if you remember the vision, one of the smaller horns became large and great and expanded its power and reached as far as the beautiful land, which I think many commentators would agree would be the land of Palestine. And so a ram, a goat that expands, one horn, four horns, breaks down, expands its business. And as we're told, this is a vision of the future, as you can see there. The vision of the evening, the vision of the evenings and mornings that has been given you is true, but seal up the distant, for it concerns the distant future, all right? It concerns the distant future. Now, it's generally recognized, and this is for your information, background information, it's generally recognized that what is being talked about is a prophetic vision of the events that's going to unfold over the next 400 years from Daniel's time. It's a prophetic vision of the events unfolding. Firstly, the ram represents the rise and eventual fall of so-called the Mede and Persian Empire. Here's a picture of the Babylonian Empire. This was the time of Belshazzar in chapters 1 through to 5, right? And this is known as the Mede and Persian Empire. And notice it's a Mede and Persian, that's why it's two horns. This was the empire that basically destroyed the Babylonian Empire. And so the picture of the ram that you see there is a prophetic vision of the rise of this empire. This empire would go on to last for 200 years. 200 years, and that was basically around the time of what's that, as you can see there. they started taking role about 560. That's around that time, right? The goat, as you can mention there, is generally agreed, is the rise of Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire. You see the picture of the Greek Empire there. Pretty, pretty big empire. And what you see also there is when the reference to the horn, which is a reference to Alexander the Great, being broken, divided by four horns, is generally recognized by historians and theologians and commentators. It's a reference to when Alexander the Great died, his empire was broken up into four empires, and that's a reference there. And out of the one empire, out of the one sub-nation, there was, again, people recognize the rise of one known as Antiochus. Do I have him down there? No, I don't have Antiochus, right? There's one known as Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a king who basically rose to power, became a very brutal and cruel person, and we will read about him a lot later on. You can see this reference here in verse 25. You see what it says there? Now, know and understand this. From the time the word goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes. There will be seven sevens, and it will be rebuilt with troubles. Let's see. That's not my reference there. I think my slide's a bit out of order here. I don't know why. Okay, don't worry about that, right? Yes, this is the problem with technology sometimes. I checked it out, right? But ignore that sort of thing, all right? Let's go back to this sort of thing, all right? Ignore that sort of thing. What you find is when the Greek Empire, when Alexander dies, his empire is divided into four. The four empires, out of the one empire comes a great king, a treacherous king known as Antiochus, and he is a cruel king who actually begins a serious persecution of the Jewish people at the time, trying to Hellenize them, and that is actually referred to in verse 25. Oh, it is in 25. No, it's not verse 25, it's the wrong one. I don't know why it is there. Interesting here, because in my verse 25, that must be a different... Oh, that's why! I wrote down 9:25, it should have been 8:25. So ignore that 8:25. Let me read to you 9:25 in your books there. He will cause the seed to prosper. He will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the Prince of Peace. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human powers. So essentially what you have here is a reference, a prophetic vision of the next 400 years of human history. From the fall of Babylon to the rise of the Median Persian Empire, to the rise of the Greek Empire, to the rise of one Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth, all that will cover a span of 400 years. 400 years. Is it any surprising then that Daniel is appalled by the vision? He doesn't understand it. Who would think about it, that if you're given about a vision about the 400 years about wars and terrible dictator and so on, would you not be scared by that sort of thing? And Daniel himself was terrified by what he see. He didn't understand what was going on. He heard it but didn't understand it. But the question we've got to ask before us now is, what does that have to do with us? What does the rise of the Persian Empire got to do with us here in 2025, here in Australia? What does the rise of the Greek Empire and the rise of Antiochus Epiphanes have to do with us here in Sydney in 2025? This is ancient history. For us, it might have been Daniel's future in the next 400 years, but for us, it is ancient history of a Middle Eastern country that is, for us, has no relevance. And here I want to highlight three very important points for us to consider. One, that when you look at these passages, this particular vision in chapter 8, and the passages that follow in chapters 10 to 12, which we'll look at in a couple of weeks' time, it reminds us that God's purposes and plans are worked out in history. And I want to notice the word history. In other words, all the affairs and events that's talked about, both in terms of the rise of the Mede and Persian Empire and the Greek Empire and Antiochus Epiphanes, they're not random and chaotic events, nor are they merely distant, irrelevant events. They all point to one very important thing, and that is that God's purposes and plans are worked out in history. That's why I emphasize history. In other words, all these events are, in a mysterious way, part of God's purposes to bring about his plans for the world. They all operate in concert with each other to achieve God's ultimate purposes. This is why in many scholars they talk about salvation history. Salvation history is not talking about the history of salvation. How did here? It's talking about the fact that God's salvation purposes are worked out in and through the events of history. That includes the rise of Babylon, the fall of Babylon, the rise and the fall of the Mede Persian Empire, the rise and the fall of the Greek Empire, etc., etc. God's purposes are worked out in history. Now, that's important for Daniel and people like us to understand. Why is that? Because when Daniel looked at what was going on around him, when he looked at his nation falling apart at the rise of the Babylonians, and then being told that the Medes and Persians says, now what's going on here? Daniel needs to be reminded of one very important thing. And what's that important thing? You see this back in Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And what? The Lord delivered. You see that word? The Lord delivered. That is, Israel wasn't handed over by some mightier nation. More deeper still is the fact that God gave them over to the Babylonians. This was a truth which Nebuchadnezzar need to understand too, because what does it say? God's vision to Nebuchadnezzar is this: Your Majesty, you are the King of Kings, the God has given you dominion. In other words, you didn't take these nations because you're a much more strategic leader. It was the fact that God gave it to you. Now, a lot of times we hear it, we don't get it. And so God had to do a very hard thing in Daniel, in Nebuchadnezzar's life. He had to humiliate him. And when he finally was humiliated, he came to his senses. And what did Nebuchadnezzar come to realize? What was God having to teach Nebuchadnezzar again? Seven times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all the kingdoms of earth and gives them to anyone he wishes. You hear that? So he had to be reminded again, who's in charge? Not you, Nebuchadnezzar. God is in charge. And when Nebuchadnezzar came to his senses, what do we read here in chapter 4? In verse 35, this is Nebuchadnezzar's recognition. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the powers of and the people of earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, what have you done? This chapter here then follows in the same line as that. God is the one who gives kingdoms, he raises kingdoms and brings down kingdoms as he so chooses. God is the one who handed the Babylonians over to the Medes. And God is the one who handed the Medes over to the Greeks. And God is the one who raised up this treacherous ruler to persecute the people, God's people. You know what? He's the one who is the Lord, not just of your life. He's the Lord of world affairs. Have a look at this, will you? Now, you see that document, you see that graph? That is a picture in many ways of the rise and fall of different empires for so many thousands of years. Well, 1,500 years, from 1,500 to 2,000. And you can go extend it further back, right? It's a picture of, as it says, the standing of great empires. There you have a picture of the rise of United States, you have Netherlands, India, Japan, Spain, China, Germany, Russia, United Kingdom, France, Ottoman Empire, etc., etc. Here's another picture of a map, similar, right? This is much bigger, and you can say it's pretty messy of all the different kingdoms there, right? Different nations and so on like that, all kingdoms and empires come and go and so on like that. And you look at the questions, and you've got to ask yourself the question, right? Here's the question I say, what is the sense in all this? If Daniel is right, the question you're going to ask, did God raise up the Roman Empire to defeat the Greek Empire? Did God raise up Islam through Muhammad to destroy Christendom and expand Islamic territory? Did God raise up Genghis Khan in the 1200s to expand the Mongol Empire? Did God raise the Black Plague to wipe out a third of the European nation? More closer to home, did God raise up the Russians to invade Ukraine? Did God put Trump in power? Did God raise up Hitler to conquer Poland and Japan to attack Pearl Harbor? What would you say to that? See, when you look at this, Daniel tells us that God is the one who raises up nations and brings them down. He is the one who raises up all these nations and brings them down. When you look at a graph like that, you can think, wow, the person who put that together is very clever, very articulate, very sort of creative. But behind it all, really even much more serious and more divine, is the hand of God. He is the one who actually created these nations, who raised up these nations and brought them down in their precise time. As I said, history is the stage upon which God's plans and purposes are being worked out. Now, you've got to ask yourself, why is that so important? And I want to say it's important because it reminds us that if God can do the bigger things, God is also intricately involved in the smaller details of all our affairs. In fact, the reason why nations rise and fall is not because of a few decisions that the leader makes, but usually because of a thousand and million little decisions that line up every day that bring the rise of a nation and bring it down. Let me give an example, a quick example of how that works in, say, going to work, right? We think that going to work is a very ordinary, mundane, everyday activity, going to work. You wake up, you get dressed, you grab a coffee and drive to work. It seems straightforward, but this routine, this very simple one routine that we do every day depends on thousands upon thousands of small things working together perfectly. Think about, say, waking up. You wake up to go to work depends on your heart beating properly, your lungs breathing properly, your eyes see, your brain is focused, all without conscious effort. You know what? You're healthy to get up to go to work. Well, you get up. But also, it depends on the alarm, doesn't it? Your alarm goes off, powered by electricity. You have clean water to shower, food in the fridge, and clothes to wash that are ready to wear as well. And you can't, and then you get in the car to go to work or train a bus. Your vehicle starts thanks to charged batteries, a working engine, fuel, and tires with grip. It was manufactured through a global supply chain of parts from dozens of countries. Roads are paved and maintained and managed by local infrastructures, and traffic light works and other drivers follow rules enabling safe travel. And then you have your job. You get to work safely and there's your job. Your employee exists because of an economy built on trade, trust, and law. The internet power are running at the office. You're paid through a banking system that securely processes salary. A global infrastructure supports all that. And don't forget about time. All this runs clockwork because it depends on atomic oscillations working in harmony to make sure you get to your places on time. You see, each of this, right, what we do every day is merely the tip of an iceberg. Beneath it is a network of technology, governance, natural resources, human labor, and shared system. It is merely the tip of the iceberg. See, your going to work isn't a simple task. It's a miracle of coordination, largely invisible, but absolutely essential. And this is just one person going to work. Just think about that multiplied by 7 billion times. If that's what happens with you going to work, what does it take to raise up a nation? Does it take one leader who's just a strategic thinker? Or is it the alignment of millions upon millions upon millions of small decisions? What does it take for a person to, for a nation to come down? Is it just one bad decision? Or is the alignment of millions and millions and millions of decisions that go on underneath, beneath the iceberg? You see, what the Bible tells us is that when God raises nations and brings them down, it is only because, and possible, because God is at work in all the intricate details to align them, to raise up a nation, and to bring them down. See, when you look at chapter 8, it reminds us that in the story of the rise of the Mede Empire and the rise of the Greek Empire and the rise of this guy Antiochus, God is at work in history, in the details, even in your life, to bring about his good purposes. We talk about salvation history. But that leads us to the second point. God's purpose and plans will involve his people's suffering. Have a look at what it says here. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, how long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, the surrender of the sanctuary, and the trampling underfoot of the Lord's people. And have a look at the interpretation of that. He will become very strong, referring to Antiochus, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy those who are mighty, the holy people. And what's it saying here? That part of God's purposes and plans involves the suffering of his people. Your suffering and the suffering of God's people, of all God's people in the world, has never been accidental. It's been intentional, it's been strategic, and here's the hard thing about it, it's been part of God's big picture and God's plan. God had talked about that back in chapter 8, and you see throughout the history, we see the same thing. We all know that God's people are one of the most persecuted people in the world. Throughout centuries, God's people have been hunted down and arrested, tortured, beaten, their belongings taken away. And we often pray for their freedom and for their protection, and rightly so. But sometimes there is none of that. God's people still gets persecuted, still arrested, still beaten, still tortured, and still in prison. And why is that? There is no easy answer to that question. There is no easy answer to the question. There is a tip of the iceberg as to why God chooses to allow his people, in fact, to ensure that to make their suffering part of his plan. Why is that? You see glimpses of that in the Bible. But in the long and short of it is that your suffering is part of God's plan to bring about his good purposes. And that's an important thing for us to understand. But that brings us to the third point. God's purpose and the plans will climax in making the Lamb the everlasting King. Have a look at what it says here in chapter 8, verse 14. He said to me, it will take 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. And what's that referring to? Look at verse 25, chapter 8. Is that right? Yep, 8:25. He will cause deceit, this is Antiochus, to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his hand, stand against the prince of princes, yet he will be destroyed, not by human power. Now, invariably, if you read the history books, Antiochus Epiphanes IV died of an illness, and that can be a reference to why it was not by human hands. He wasn't destroyed by other people, but by sickness. But if you read the Bible, you know that sickness, in the course of God's plan, is God's providential work to bring about his good purposes. Everything that happens, no matter how natural it might seem, is because of God's good work behind it. He raises up people and he brings them down. This is the point that God himself will bring an end to the madness of the world and bring an end to the suffering of the world. And what will he do? He will install his own kingdom. We see this again in chapter 2. In the time of the kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left on other people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. That is to say that as God works out his purpose and plan throughout history involving the suffering of his people, one day it will all come to its climactic end. And when will that be? When God sets up his own kingdom. You see this again in chapter 4, where God has to remind Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar comes to his senses. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. And you see this also in chapter 7 that Daniel brought up last week. But the courts will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty and power and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. That was what Daniel saw as the future. But here on this side, that vision is something that is being presented to us today, and in many ways, it's a reality even today. How so? Because you go into the New Testament, what does Paul say in New Testament, right? In him we have redemption through the blood, the forgiveness of sins, in accordance with the riches of his grace, that he lavished on us with all wisdom and understanding. He made known to us the mysteries will according to his good pleasure, which he purposed in Christ. And what is that? To be put into effect when the times reach their fulfillment. And what is that? To bring all things in heaven and on earth under Christ. See, what is the purpose of all that we see happening? Why did God raise up the Medes? Why did God raise up the Greeks? Why did God raise up Antiochus? Why did God people suffer? Why did God raise up this nation, destroy that nation, and raise up that nation, destroy that nation? It's simple. It's all in concert working towards this one grand plan to see Jesus being exalted as the King over all kings. He is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. It's interesting when we read on that last day, what do we read here? On the very last day, again, that was borne out last week. Then I looked and heard this voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 upon thousands. They encircled the throne, the one living creature and the living creatures and the elders. In a loud voice, they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." What does it mean for all of us today, right? What does it mean for all of us? It means this. When you understand chapter 8 and what God is doing in the world, it should bring you comfort. It brings comfort because we live in a turbulent time of where it's chaotic and havoc, and superpowers seem to be calling the shots. But when you understand that God is at work, it brings great comfort that the world seems messy, but everything is working to plan. But it should bring humility as well, because we're not in charge. We're not in charge of many things. Most things, we're not in charge. God is in control. But should give us courage whilst to face the future. Courage to face the future. No matter how crazy the world will look in the future, God is still in control. And therefore, we can move forward with great courage, whatever the cost it might mean. But lastly, it should call us to worship. Because at the end of the day, God is the one who rules and calls the shots. He's directing everything with precision. And everything is according to plan. And at the end of the day, everything will come under the reign of the Lord Jesus. And he will be worshipped by all in heaven and on earth. And it should all lead us to worship. As in the words of Nebuchadnezzar back in chapter 4. "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Should lead us to comfort, humility, courage, and worship. Daniel 8's a crazy passage. It's a crazy passage about some sort of, about history, about superpowers, but in the biggest scheme of things, it is God working out his purposes and plan through the affairs and the events of human history to bring about the installation of Jesus as the Lord of Lords and King of Kings over all things. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we look at the world around us. It's a turbulent time, Lord, of superpowers grabbing for power, of wars, of just havoc, Lord, of your people suffering throughout the world. And yet you remind us here in Daniel 8 that you are the God who's in charge, who rules all things, who directs history, and who's directing all history to its ultimate climax, to see Jesus as Lord over all things. We give you thanks that we can find comfort in that, that we can find courage. Teach us to be humble as Nebuchadnezzar was humbled. And Lord, teach us to worship your Son, because that is the goal of all things. In Jesus' name, amen.